From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
5 years after Operation Enduring Freedom began in Afghanistan, the Taliban, or some version of them, are back in power in the south, and warlords are back in power in the north. Meanwhile, women and ordinary people in Afghanistan are caught between the forces of religious fundamentalism and Western imperialism.
Washington warlords and the propaganda of silence. On the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, we speak with the authors of the new book, Bleeding Afghanistan. Then, challenging Columbus Day.
Today, the United States continues to fight the Indian Wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Philippines, in Colombia, where they continue to call any territory that is not under the control of the U.S. military Indian country.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations is estimating 100,000 people in southern Afghanistan have been forced from their homes since July due to heavy fighting between the Taliban and NATO forces. Earlier today, two suicide bombers blew themselves up in eastern Afghanistan. A police officer was killed and 16 people were injured. There have been 90 suicide attacks so far this year in Afghanistan, killing around 170 civilians. There were only 30 such attacks in the first 4 years of the war. Saturday marks the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. We'll have more on Afghanistan in a few minutes. In Iraq, the body of a Kurdish lawmaker was found yesterday after he and his driver were shot in the head. The lawmaker, Mohammad Reza Mohammed, is the first Iraqi parliament member in the current government to be assassinated. Members of the Iraqi parliament are permitted to hire up to 20 bodyguards, but Mohammed had none with him when he was attacked. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice made a surprise visit to Iraq Thursday. Her landing in Baghdad was delayed for nearly an hour because of a mortar attack near the airport. Rice maintained Iraqis are making progress. However, a leading Republican senator who just returned from Iraq disagrees. John Warner, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said Iraq's taken steps backward and that the United States should consider a change of course if the security situation doesn't improve in the next 2 or 3 months. Earlier in the week, the Pentagon announced the number of planted bombs had reached an all-time high in Iraq. Since Saturday, 24 U.S. soldiers have been killed. Human Rights Watch has revealed armed Shiite groups in Iraq have threatened to kill Palestinian refugees living in Baghdad if they don't leave Iraq within 72 hours. Virtually all Palestinians in Iraq are Sunni Muslim. Human Rights Watch said it has obtained flyers from a Shia group that state there is no place for Palestinians in Iraq. Trucks with loudspeakers have been broadcasting similar messages in parts of Baghdad. Here in this country, House Speaker Dennis Hastert refused to resign Thursday over his handling of the Mark Foley scandal. Hastert's office knew for months Foley was sending inappropriate internet messages to underage boys. But the House Speaker allowed Foley to stay on as co-chair of the House Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children. During a press conference Thursday, Hastert denied he'd done anything wrong.
Ultimately, any time that a person has to, as a leader, be on the hot seat and he is a detriment to the party, there ought to be a change. I became speaker in a situation like that. I don't think that's the case. I said I haven't done anything wrong, obviously, and we need to come back. What we need to do is start talking about the issue.
The House Ethics Committee has announced it'll investigate how Congress handled early warnings that Foley had inappropriate relationships with underage boys working on Capitol Hill. In North Carolina, 17,000 people have been ordered to evacuate their homes after a large chemical plant fire sent a dangerous chlorine cloud across the town of Apex. At least 18 people have already been hospitalized. Flames from the plant shot 150 feet in the air and burned throughout the night. The plant handled toxic waste, including pesticides and PCBs. The plant is owned by the Detroit-based company Environmental Quality. The company was forced to shut down a hazardous waste recycling and treatment plant near Detroit in 2005 after an explosion there sparked a fire. In news from Africa, the Sudanese government warned Thursday it will view the deployment of UN peacekeeping troops to Darfur as a hostile act and a prelude to an invasion. Sudan issued the warning in a letter to African and Arab nations. In response, the United States called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. This is U.S. Ambassador John Bolton.
An unprecedented assertion by a government that's about to be the beneficiary of an extended UN peacekeeping mission, attempting to intimidate potential troop-contributing countries and to assert that a humanitarian mission to prevent genocide in Darfur is the prelude to an invasion of the country. So this is a direct challenge to the authority of the Security Council in its efforts to alleviate the tragedy in Darfur. And clearly requires a strong response by the Security Council.
In media news, the Chicago-based Tribune Company has fired Los Angeles Times publisher Jeffrey Johnson just weeks after he refused to eliminate as many as 100 newsroom positions at the paper. The Tribune Company wanted the Los Angeles Times to slash its reporting staff in an effort to save money. Both Johnson and Times editor Dean Baquet refused. The Tribune Company named David Hiller to be the new publisher. He served in the Reagan Justice Department alongside Chief Justice John Roberts and former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. The Times deputy sports editor William Rempel said the staff has no confidence in Tribune management to do what's right for journalism or the newspaper. Calls have increased for local ownership of the Los Angeles Times. The Chicago-based Tribune Company also owns 10 other papers, including the Chicago Tribune, two dozen TV stations, including KTLA in Los Angeles, and the Chicago Cubs baseball team. Meanwhile, the advertising policies of Los Angeles Times are also coming under scrutiny. Last week, the group Free Press attempted to take out an advertisement in the paper to announce the FCC's public hearings in Los Angeles on the new media ownership rules. The Los Angeles Times originally said the ad would cost $25,000, then bumped the price up to over $100,000 because they claimed it was an advocacy advertisement. Craig Aaron of Free Press says the paper then offered a lower rate, but only on certain conditions.
They said they would give us the $40,000 rate on this revised ad as long as we removed the phrase, quote, that would allow the largest media companies to get even bigger, which is how we described the new rules being put forward by the FCC, and we deleted any mention of our own website. The Tribune Company just happens to be the primary mover behind the push to end the ban on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership.
Free Press decided not to take out the ad. CBS's 60 Minutes is reporting it's obtained the government's secret no-fly list used to screen airline passengers for possible terrorist suspects. The list contains 44,000 entries, including common names like Gary Smith, John Williams, and Robert Johnson, shared by thousands of passengers. 60 Minutes interviewed 12 people named Robert Johnson. All of them said they're detained almost every time they fly. The list also includes Bolivian President Evo Morales and Nabi Berri, the parliamentary speaker in Lebanon. 14 of the 19 September 11th hijackers are still on the no-fly list. In labor news, the Republican-controlled National Labor Relations Board has issued a new ruling that could block millions of nurses and other workers from joining a union. The board broadened its definition of who can be considered a supervisor. Under federal law, employees defined as supervisors are not entitled to legal protections, ensuring their right to join unions. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney said the board's decision would immediately deny as many as 8 million workers their basic right to have a voice on the job. A new study has criticized PBS's flagship news program, The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, for having relying too much on white male Republican sources. The study, conducted by the media watch group FAIR, that's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, found NewsHour interviewed four times as many male sources as women. People of color made up 15% of U.S. sources. Among partisan sources, Republicans outnumbered Democrats on the NewsHour by a 2-to-1 ratio. On the issue of Iraq, the show interviewed five times as many guests who advocated staying the course over withdrawing troops. According to FAIR, no peace activists were interviewed on Iraq during the study's six-month period. Today marks the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the Cuban Flight 455, which took the lives of all 73 people on board. It was the first and only mid-air bombing of a civilian airliner in the Western Hemisphere. Declassified U.S. documents implicate the anti-Castro Cuban exile and CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles in the bombing. Posada is currently in U.S. custody, but the U.S. government has refused to extradite him to Cuba or Venezuela to face trial. He escaped from a Venezuelan prison in 1985 while awaiting a trial on appeal. Posada snuck into the United States 18 months ago after years of living and hiding in Latin America. He's being held in a Texas detention center. A federal judge recently ruled Posada should be freed pending deportation, but U.S. immigration officials said Thursday Posada will remain in custody. Cuba has accused the Bush administration of having a double standard on prosecuting terrorists. This is Ricardo Alarcón, president of the Cuban National Assembly.
30 years after the crime in Barbados, we can clearly prove the responsibility of the U.S. government in this atrocious act of terrorism. It is still unpunished. Why? What explanation could there be for this obstinance in obstructing justice?
Activists from Greenpeace have created giant crop circles in cornfields in Spain, the Philippines, and Mexico as part of a campaign to protect corn from being contaminated from genetically engineered varieties. Greenpeace is calling for a worldwide ban on the release of any transgenic crop or seed and for governments to stop the commercial and experimental growing of genetically engineered crops. Here in New York, student demonstrators at Columbia University disrupted a speech by Jim Gilchrist, founder of the anti-immigrant group The Minutemen Project. Over 20 students stormed the stage after Gilchrist came to the microphone. Two students unfurled a banner reading, "No human being is illegal." Backers of Gilchrist also proceeded up to the stage, setting off a brief brawl. In an update in a story we've been following, the military has announced it'll convene a court-martial to try Suzanne Swift. She's the U.S. soldier who was arrested and confined to base for going AWOL after her charges of sexual harassment and assault went unaddressed by the military. The military's charged her with being absent without leave and missing movement. Swift has refused to return to Iraq, where she says she was sexually harassed by a commanding officer. She was in Iraq for a year. The World Association of Newspapers says 2006 has become the deadliest year for journalists and media workers on record. So far, 75 journalists have died this year. 26 of the deaths occurred in Iraq. And thousands of protesters rallied around the country Thursday in demonstrations organized by the group World Can't Wait. Over 200 protests were scheduled. This is Jean Sarah Rowe, the former New School student who criticized John McCain at the school's graduation ceremonies.
I'm here today because I want to have a clean conscience. I want to have children one day, and I want to be able to look them in the eye and to tell them that I did all that I could do, that I did not stand idly by while some people with no regard for human life tortured other people under the banner of my flag. That I did not look on with bewilderment as my government sent an entire region of the world into chaos and war. That I did not just wait around as my government took away a woman's right to choose. My strong optimism about our future is what brings me here today.
You can see Jean Sarah Rowe's commencement address at the New School when she followed John McCain's address and criticized him at our website, democracynow.org. Outgoing Democratic Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney also spoke at the rally in New York.
Untold Iraqis are dead, thousands of Americans are dead, and tens of thousands are wounded. But what happens to any of us who question the White House and point out their shining lies? First of all, we're targeted as enemies. Then, labeled un-American. Accused of hating our country. And one by one, we're isolated.
Congressmember McKinney recently lost her re-election bid. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend marks the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. 50 cruise missiles were launched from submarines in the Arabian Sea. B-52 and B-2 stealth bombers began airstrikes. The Pentagon called the attack Operation Enduring Freedom. The invasion came less than a month after 9/11. Among the Bush administration's goals, they said, were the capture of Osama bin Laden and the dismantling of the Taliban. 5 years later, neither objective has been realized. In recent months, the Taliban seized control of entire regions of the country. The security situation has worsened as suicide bombings are up 600% this year. Opium and poppy cultivation are at record highs. NATO forces are suffering their highest casualty rate in 5 years. The number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan has now reached about 20,000, the highest number of U.S. forces in the country since the invasion. Meanwhile, the Bush administration continues to hold hundreds of prisoners without charge at Bagram Air Base. My next guests are the authors of the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington, Warlords, and the Propaganda of Silence. Sonali Kohatkar and James Ingalls are also co-directors of the Afghan Women's Mission. They traveled to Afghanistan last year to witness firsthand the results of U.S. policy there and to understand how ordinary Afghans felt about the war. Sonali and Jim join us from Los Angeles. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. And, of course, Sonali is also the host of the popular Pacifica radio program Uprising on KPFK in Los Angeles. Sonali, let's begin with you. Let's go back 5 years. What has happened since that time and the reasons that were given for the attack on Afghanistan?
Yes, Amy. The reasons, of course, were that 9/11 had just happened. It was less than a month after September 11, 2001, that the United States launched its attack, its so-called Operation Enduring Freedom, on Afghanistan, dropping bombs and basically going in saying that they were going to liberate the people, in particular liberate the women of Afghanistan. You know, thousands of people were killed in the bombings alone. Untold numbers were killed, probably due to starvation. The Taliban was defeated. And what the U.S. did in those 5 years was that it refused to allow the expansion of peacekeeping troops from Kabul to the rest of the country, saying that it would interfere with the so-called hunt for Taliban and al-Qaeda. And it re-empowered these misogynist and fundamentalist warlords in the northern part of the country and allowed them to take power in government. Now, certainly on paper, women are more equal to men than they were before. But in practical terms, very little has actually changed in Afghanistan for women. There's increased sexual and domestic violence against women. Women parliamentarians are harassed and threatened. And now, with its operations in the southern part of the country being extremely aggressive, targeting Afghans, rounding them up, brutalizing them, torturing them, the U.S. has actually created much more resentment against it than it needed to. There was actually some goodwill that the Afghan people had. The Afghans were willing to tolerate some foreign presence in Afghanistan in order to see if the Taliban or the warlords would be really defeated, would be purged from their country. The U.S. has squandered that goodwill with its brutal tactics in Afghanistan. And now the Taliban, or some version of the Taliban, the neo-Taliban as they're being called, are back in the south. And so Afghanistan is actually worse off than it was just a couple of years ago.
Jim Ingalls, this week, the NATO forces took over in Afghanistan. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, well, what that means essentially is that we have more troops in Afghanistan from more countries operating under the same U.S. generals that have always been running the show. The U.S. continues to run the combat operations in Afghanistan. Nominally, the NATO operation is under a British general right now, but the so-called security operations of NATO are being run by Major General Benjamin Freakley, who's a U.S. general. He's what they're calling a dual-hatted general who has one hat he works for NATO and the other hat he works for Operation Enduring Freedom. So the combat operations are still being run in a U.S. style, with a U.S. style approach, under a U.S. general. In fact, the overall NATO operation is going to be taken over by another U.S. general in February. So it's all a continuous flow from what's been going on since 2001. The only change is now there are more troops from more countries.
U.S. is still in control of Bagram Air Base?
U.S. is still in control of Bagram Air Base.
Where the prisoners?
U.S. is... Yes, that's right. And the U.S. is still in control of combat operations.
Jim Ingalls and Sonali Kohatkar are our guests. We'll come back to them in a minute.
محبت ندید بودم دل ها رمید بودم محبت ندید بودم نجبا کشید بودم نجبا کشید بودم گرفتار شدم بدام گرفتار شدم بدام
Ancient Chant of Kabul here on Democracy Now! By Beltran. We're talking to Jim Ingalls and Sonali Kohatkar. They are the authors of the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. Sonali is also the host of the KPFK radio program Uprising every weekday morning in Los Angeles. They're speaking to us from Los Angeles. Sonali, can you talk about the position of Republicans and Democrats here in this country on Afghanistan today, and also the current visit of the President Hamid Karzai to the United States?
Sure. Now, it's very interesting to see the kind of debate that goes on in the United States over this issue. You know, Amy, we were just in Canada where there's a very big debate going on among Canadians about the presence of Canadian troops in Afghanistan. There's only 2,300 Canadian troops there. And there's actually a party, the New Democratic Party in Canada, which has based its platform on a pullout of Canadian troops from Afghanistan. Coming here to the United States again, it was really interesting to see the kind of debate that exists. On the one hand, Democrats are saying, look, particularly Senator Kerry and Bill Clinton are saying the real fight is in Afghanistan. The just war, the war that we're supposed to be fighting against terrorism is actually in Afghanistan. We need to put more troops there because things aren't going so well. And the Republicans are saying things are going very well in Afghanistan. It was the first stop in the war on terror. It's been our success story. We need to put more troops there, but it's going very, very well. And that's the extent of the debate we're seeing between Republicans and Democrats. They both of them agree that more troops have to go into Afghanistan, and they sort of disagree on whether it's going well or not. But if you look at what's been happening in Afghanistan over the past few years regarding troops, the more the number of troops in Afghanistan over the past few years, the greater the instability, the greater the violence, not only from the side of U.S. forces, Western forces in general, but then the reaction from Afghans. And so as a whole, the country is actually less safe. And I think even the anti-war movement in this country is not quite sure about Afghanistan. I know Neil Young, for example, who's put out this anti-war album, recently said, you know, we shouldn't be in Iraq. Afghanistan is where we're supposed to be. And it's really bizarre for us who have been studying the situation for a long time, who see the similarities with Afghanistan and Iraq, to hear people cast Afghanistan as a so-called just war. It's really a shame.
And the issue of the leader of the Senate, Bill Frist, saying that Taliban should be included in the government, that they're popular. What is their popularity and your response to Frist's statement?
Maybe Jim should answer that one.
We're talking to Sonali Kohatkar as well as Jim Ingalls, and together they've written the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. Jim?
Yeah, I mean, this really illustrates the scope of our debate. We have the debate is over which warlord armies to support in the U.S., the Northern Alliance warlords that we brought back to power to topple the Taliban, or the Taliban. So it's a question of one or the other. It's never a question of what do the Afghan people want. And the popularity of the Taliban now is rising because of U.S. actions. And some analysts are essentially saying that the Taliban, the original Taliban, no longer exist in Afghanistan as they used to be. What's happening is a new wave of anti-U.S. sentiment is fomenting in Afghanistan because of U.S. actions, because of the bombings, because of the torture, the death in custodies that are so well known, because of U.S. actions in Iraq. New foot soldiers are rising from out of the population because people feel like they're occupied by a foreign force unjustly. 70% of the population in southern and eastern Afghanistan is on the fence. They're basically they're waiting to see who wins the war, NATO or the Taliban, before they decide who they're going to back. And that's a very telling statistic. It basically equates, it says that in the eyes of the population, NATO, the U.S.-run operation, and the Taliban are more or less the same thing. So we've become the new warlords in Afghanistan.
And the issue of drugs, Jim, the issue of heroin, of poppy?
Poppies. Most people are very poor, and they basically need, they've turned to growing poppies to survive. And Afghanistan has now become the largest supplier of opium to the world. 87% of the world supply comes from Afghanistan, and that's mainly because of poor farmers need to make a living. That's the only way they can make a living. Not necessarily them that's making the profits. Most of the profits are going to middlemen who are selling the drugs on the world market. So the poor farmers of Afghanistan are basically caught with very little choice but to grow poppies. The Taliban are taking advantage of that and are actually looking better in the eyes of some people because they're allowing people to grow poppies, whereas the U.S. is seen as an anti-drug, anti-poppy force.
Sonali Kohatkar, the issue of the provincial women's affairs minister who was recently killed in Afghanistan. Can you talk more about what is happening to women there? I mean, I think about Laura Bush giving the first, First Lady radio address a Saturday a year or two ago, talking about how women are gaining their rights in Afghanistan.
Yeah, you know, we write about this in our book. We have a chapter in our book that really goes into the kind of liberation rhetoric that was used after 9/11. You know, after 9/11, the Bush administration suddenly became a feminist administration. You know, it was bizarre to see George W. Bush and Laura Bush, which, of course, compared to the Taliban, ultra-Republicans and conservatives, do appear feminist, right? But it was really bizarre to see them jump on this bandwagon to liberate Afghan women, and it was a deliberate ploy. It was a way to get well-meaning Americans on the side of this war to justify, you know, not only are we going to get revenge for 9/11, we're going to free the women. And what happened? What happened was that they basically assumed that by defeating the Taliban, Afghan women were going to somehow automatically be freed. Now, in the last 5 years or so, Afghan women in the West have been burning themselves to death. There have been dozens of women who have been burning themselves to death. Women like the woman who was just killed in Afghanistan have been paying the price. They've been attacked by the fundamentalists who are basically seeing them as collaborating with the Americans or collaborating with the U.S.-run central government in Afghanistan. Things for women are okay in Kabul in terms of freedom to wear what they want to wear, a little more access to employment and healthcare, etc. But you step outside Kabul, as we did a year ago when we traveled, and it feels like the country is still under Taliban control. There's still a fundamentalist reign of terror in Afghanistan that Afghan women are caught between. There's a climate of fear, much of it because of these U.S.-backed warlords in the north. And what's happening to Afghan women is that before the Taliban, during the Taliban, and after the Taliban, they are suffering from a lifespan of 45 years, the highest maternal mortality and infant mortality rates in the world today. Afghanistan is the hungriest country. So in addition to the attacks from misogynist fundamentalists, being caught between, you know, the U.S. forces and these fundamentalists. They're also starving to death. And this is important. There are hardly any schools. Schools are being burnt down in various parts of the country. Just this year alone, dozens of schools were burnt down and hundreds more shut down. These are girls' schools shut down because of fear. So women still have no access to the very fundamental rights that they were struggling for under the Taliban. And Bush tries to convince us that they've somehow been liberated. We have to see through this. And we have to remind ourselves that if we cared about Afghan women 5 years ago, why have we forgotten? Why have we stopped caring today?
Sonali, what do you think has to happen right now in Afghanistan?
I think what has to happen is the U.S. and NATO forces absolutely have to stop their aggressive tactics. They're trying to convince the American people that they're fighting the so-called war on terror. And what are they doing? They're basically hunting down, they're rounding people up, ordinary people, they're killing them, they're calling them Taliban. They're saying these are suspected Taliban. And that's really creating a lot of anger and fear and strengthening fundamentalist forces. So the U.S. and NATO have to stop their aggressive tactics, preferably leave Afghanistan. Now, that doesn't mean we must just walk away from Afghanistan. We as a people have a responsibility. You know, our hands are soaked in the blood of the Afghan people. This was a refrain we heard often in Afghanistan. And the Afghan people want international peacekeepers, real peacekeepers, like the kind that were in Kabul under the United Nations for the first few years. Today, Kabul is the safest city in the country. International peacekeepers to the rest of the country is what's needed in Afghanistan, not the war fighters. Accompanying that, we must have disarmament. We must have reparations for the, you know, all the dollars we spent destroying Afghanistan. We must pay them back dollar for dollar in helping rebuild their country so that there's a space for them to breathe, so that there's a space for them to take back their country and actually exercise democracy. The Afghan people want democracy. They say if it's good enough for you people in the West, it's good enough for us. And they really desperately want that because they need to be freed from these twin evils of Western imperialism and religious fundamentalism. And it's usually Western imperialism that has actually created and fueled religious fundamentalism in Afghanistan.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Sonali Kohatkar and James Ingalls. Their book is called Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence, speaking to us from Los Angeles. As we turn now to, well, Columbus Day. Monday is called Columbus Day in the United States, supposed to commemorate the arrival of Christopher Columbus to the so-called New World in 1492. But that holiday has long caused anger amongst people of color, especially Native Americans, who object to honoring a man who opened the door to European colonization, the exploitation of Native peoples, and the slave trade. The first state commemoration of Columbus Day was in Colorado. And when our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour visited the state last week, I sat down with two people who were working to transform the holiday. Glenn Morris is a member of the Leadership Council of the American Indian Movement of Colorado. He's an attorney and associate professor of political science at the University of Colorado, Denver. Glenn Spagnola is a member of Transform Columbus Day Alliance and the director of PITCH, that's Progressive Italians Transforming the Columbus Day Holiday. First, I asked them about the history of Columbus Day in the state of Colorado. This is Glenn Morris.
Columbus Day began, most people don't know, as a state holiday in Colorado in 1907. But what's more important for people to understand is the ideology behind Columbus Day and why there is a Columbus Day in the United States or in Colorado. And there's been a lot of discussion lately about Hugo Chavez at the United Nations when he raised up Noam Chomsky's book, Hegemony or Survival. And if we could begin a little bit by just reducing the terms hegemony and ideology to their simplest forms. If an ideology is a set of ideas that allows a nation or a people to describe reality in terms that are comfortable for them, but more importantly, that describes the world as it should be. And hegemony is driven by a national ideology that is so comprehensive that it becomes almost invisible, like water to fish or air to human beings. And in a sense, then, we can understand Columbus Day as a hegemonic tool, the way that Chomsky uses the term, because it makes no historical sense to have a national holiday to Columbus in a country that he never visited, in a state that he never knew existed. And so we have to ask the very simple question, why does the holiday even exist? And it exists in part to advance a national ideology of celebrating invasion, conquest, and colonialism. And the proponents of the Columbus Day holiday in Colorado and Columbus parades and so on make no bones about the fact that they're celebrating the colonization of the Americas. And in fact have told us on several occasions, look, we're going to have this celebration, we're going to have these parades to Columbus, and let's get one thing straight, they say to us. This is not your country anymore. This is our country now. And you'd better get with the program. So for us, the celebration of Columbus, who was an African slave trader prior to coming to the Americas, then began the colonization of the Americas.
Explain.
Well, Columbus sailed for the Portuguese on the Gold Coast of Africa, brought back gold and slaves to the Portuguese slave market in Portugal. That's why when he arrived in the Caribbean, it became so easy for him to resort to his old practices and began to enslave Indian people to bring to the slave market in Seville. And so we believe that Columbus as a national icon is a mistake and sends certainly the wrong message to school children about what is heroic about the history of this hemisphere. Certainly the heroism of Columbus does not warrant a national holiday. In fact, he wasn't a hero. He was a slave trading Indian killer. And so that's why in the birthplace of Columbus Day here in Denver, it's such a big issue. Next year will be the centennial of the holiday, and we intend to make that a major focal point nationally.
Glenn Spagnolo, you're director of PITCH, Progressive Italians Transforming the Columbus Day Holiday. How did this holiday begin in Denver in 1907?
Well, it actually started down in Pueblo, if I'm correct. And when it got started, it's really changed from the beginning to what it is now. Now you have Italians who have latched on to this holiday, saying that this is a celebration of their Italian pride and the celebration of Christian ethics. And the more I looked at it, the more I learned that that's not really the truth. This is just propaganda used as a tool to support the white privilege that they get from the oppression of Native Americans and the colonization of America. Back in Italy, where my family came from, Columbus isn't celebrated as a national hero. In Genoa, at the quincentennial, they actually tried to shut down the city so a celebration wouldn't occur there.
What do you mean, who tried?
The Genoese who were there. The Italians, they didn't want it to be used as a tool to bring tourism to that town, so they shut down the town. So in Italy, he's viewed as the scoundrel that he is. And then being raised as a Catholic and looking at Christian ethics, there's nothing that Columbus did when he came here that supported any kind of Christian moral background. I mean, he stole, he murdered, he was greed, raped people. I mean, it was ridiculous. So to see them now say that this is a celebration of Italian pride or a Christian ethics, it's a false assertion, and it's really used to support, like I said, colonialism, the exploitation of this country from its indigenous population, and to continue the view of white privilege that exists here in the United States.
Glenn Spagmolo and Jim Norris. We'll come back to them after break. I was speaking to them on our Breaking the Sound Barrier 80-city tour as we travel the country, honoring Democracy Now! At 10, DN at 10. We are continuing that tour tonight. I'll be in Ashland, Oregon at 7:30 at Southern Oregon University. Tomorrow morning at 11:30 at the Lafayette Arinda Presbyterian Church in Lafayette, California, right near Walnut Creek. Then at 3 p.m., I'll be at Sacramento City College. Tomorrow night, I'll be at the Spangenberg Theater in Palo Alto at 6:30. And on Sunday night, back in the East Coast in Burlington, Vermont, at Champlain College at 7 p.m. You can go to our website for all the details at democracynow.org. We go to break now and then come back to our discussion about the origins of and, well, what Columbus Day means today. Stay with us.
He was a very great man. Your teaching is about Marco Polo. Oh, you said he was a very great man, so you can't blame the youth, and you can't fool the youth. You can't blame the youth.
Harper, you can't blame the youth. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country and the world, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. We're also video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are in Spanish there as well, and we make them available in audio to stations around the world. I'm Amy Goodman as we return now to the conversation I had in Denver with Glenn Morris and Glenn Spagnolo. I asked Glenn how the Italian-American community responds to his group's efforts to transform Columbus Day.
Well, obviously they've been very negative, made responses to us in the sense that, you know, we're race traitors and that we don't respect the Italian culture. But most of them have been here for generations and have actually lost touch with their own Italian culture. People who've, from immigrant families who haven't been here that long, recognize their true Italian roots and realize that this is not a celebration of it. If they wanted to have a celebration of Italian pride, I would be the first one to help them organize it, and I'm sure that the American Indian Movement would assist in that too, because they have nothing against anybody celebrating their own cultural values. But this parade, this is hate speech, plain and simple. This is not a parade. It's a convoy of conquest, as we call it. And I think that some of the members of the Sons of Italy who put this parade on are really not supporting Italian values, but are really trying instead to push an agenda. I mean, a lot of the issues that you see today, dealing with immigration, for instance, are connected directly to this parade. And the Sons of Italy realize that. Many of the members of the Sons of Italy are the same people who came out and protested the immigration marches that took place here. They've made the connection between the celebration of the colonization of this country and the oppression of the minorities here. And I think that all the other groups should look at that and make the same connections themselves.
Glenn Morris, what are your plans for this Columbus Day?
Well, for this Columbus Day, we intend to make visible our opposition to the Columbus holiday and celebrations of colonialism, as we have in the past. That is, with a large, vigorous, and lively opposition to the hate speech parade, as we call it. But really, Ms. Goodman, the point about the
you
protest.
You can call me Amy.
Thank you. The point about protesting Columbus Day and the holiday is not so much about Columbus the man or about parades. We all like parades or holidays. The point is really about the legacy of Columbus. And from the American Indian Movement of Colorado's perspective and from many indigenous people's perspectives, what's important is the way in which the United States continues to celebrate this legacy of colonialism and imperialism. And That's embodied in federal Indian law. The doctrine of discovery was institutionalized in 1823 in the Supreme Court case of Johnson versus McIntosh, where John Marshall fabricates the doctrine of discovery to justify the diminishment of Indian title to the Americas.
Explain, not in legalese. What do you mean, the doctrine of discovery?
Well, essentially what Marshall says in Johnson versus McIntosh is that by virtue of the arrival of Christian civilization, the right of native peoples to their traditional homelands and territories is diminished because of the blessings that Christian civilization have brought to the Western Hemisphere. And that opinion is the foundation for federal Indian law in the United States that continues to be enforced day after day after day till 2006. We have a case in Nevada right now with the Western Shoshones in which the title to their land was considered to be extinguished under this doctrine of discovery, not in 1823, not in 1890, in the 1980s. And it continues to the present, to the point where the United Nations, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights have said that through this doctrine of discovery, the application of the doctrine of discovery, the United States has been involved in gross violations of fundamental human rights. Now, the United States, of course, continues to ignore those decisions. But in addition to that, this doctrine of discovery and the principles of federal Indian law have been exported from the United States to be applied in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, in other English common law countries like India and Kenya and South Africa. And so this is not merely a discussion about a parade or about a holiday to a long dead historical figure. This is about a legacy that continues to drive imperialism today. And we see that embodied in the Bush administration. I don't know if you've read Robert Kaplan's book, Imperial Grunts, but Kaplan, who's a favorite of the Bush administration, and reportedly Bush read the book, Imperial Grunts, and in the book, Kaplan admits that today the United States continues to fight the Indian Wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Philippines, in Colombia, where they continue to call any territory that is not under the control of the U.S. military, Indian country. That is, it needs to be subdued. It needs to be civilized. This clash of civilizations, so-called clash of civilizations that's going on in the world today, it's not new. That was the war that was being fought in this area right here where we're sitting for many generations in order to bring the heathen territories into the civilized Christian fold. So that's really what we're talking about, is beginning to address the ideology that drove the Indian Wars. And the line can be traced continuously from October 12, 1492 to the present. So what we're saying from the American Indian Movement of Colorado, from the Transform Columbus Day Alliance, is that we can create a different future. And that's what we intend to do in the streets of Denver, is to begin a movement that says this country needs to reexamine its history. It needs to report that history differently to its children. It needs to impart certain values and moral traditions to succeeding generations, that it's not okay to go to someone else's country and steal it and kill them and engage in genocide.
Specifically in the streets, what will you do? What are the plans for direct action?
We first will have we will conduct the Four Directions March, in which people from all ethnic and racial communities, different faith-based communities, will come from four directions in Denver and converge at the state capitol. This will be the night before the parade, but the day of the parade there will be vigorous political action to express our opposition to the parade, because we believe in the birthplace of Columbus Day. It's important to set an example for the kind of, not just for what we're against, which is the expression of hate speech as embodied in the Columbus holiday, but also what we're for. And what we're for is the transformation of the holiday. And so if it takes people risking their liberty through acts of civil resistance, then perhaps that's what's in order for the day.
Glenn Spagnuolo, have you been speaking to the Italian community? Is there any dialogue taking place?
Every year there has been dialogue that took place. We've actually had conversations facilitated by human rights commissions to try to find some kind of common ground. But as Glenn has stated, the remarks are to the point of almost being belligerent, from the Sons of Italy to the fact of there is no give there. It's the view, like they said, that this is our country now and the indigenous population needs to get with the program. Those are actual quotes from some of those meetings. So when you come with a mindset like that and are not willing to give up that privilege that you have and actually meet on neutral grounds and talk, we haven't been able to obtain any kind of meaningful solution.
Did you ever feel like that?
I would say no. I mean, I did recognize that growing up, I did have a certain amount of privilege afforded to me. And, you know, as I've gotten older, I've seen that privilege. And I think it's up to every one of us who are considered in the privileged class, white males in this country, to use that privilege to try to dismantle the white identity that's been, I would say, perpetrated upon us, to be honest with you, because I think the first victim of the racist is the racist child. So I think it's up to all of us to try to use that and break down the so-called club that exists for white identity. And instead of using our privilege for gain, for materialism, to use it to try to rectify situations that exist in this country, such as the genocide that continues till today of the indigenous populations here.
Glenn Morris, you're a member of the Leadership Council of American Indian Movement, Colorado. You're also a professor at University of Colorado and an attorney. The ACLU has obtained more documents that appear to show the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force has been watching anti-war groups in Denver as part of a domestic terror investigation. This came out earlier this year. The ACLU requested the files after people and groups were questioned by authorities regarding their involvement in protests in Colorado Springs in 2003 and the Denver Columbus Day Parade of 2002.
Before I answer that question, if you don't mind, I'd like to address your previous question to Glenn Spagnuolo. The characterization that the hate speech paraders are the Italian community, I think, is a mistake. I think in the protests that we've had in the past, frankly, we've had more members of the Italian community protesting the parade than have been in the parade. And so I think in these kinds of discussions, language becomes extremely important. And so when the characterization is that the Italian community supports the parade, I think part of that is generational. I think that certainly younger Italian Americans feel no particular allegiance to Christopher Columbus or to the ideology of Columbus or invasion. So I hope that we can make that clear. And we encourage Italian Americans from across the country, across the world, in fact. In fact, we have Italians from Italy who have vehemently expressed their opposition to the Columbus Day celebration in the United States. So so I'd like to dispel that fallacy that this is somehow some monolithic position within the Italian American community, or that this is an Indian versus Italian conflict, because it's not. It's about people of goodwill who want to convert racism into anti-racism. And so that really is the essence of it. But to your question about the JTTF and the Denver Police Department spy files, to us, that's an expression of the Colombian legacy. When first this spy files story broke in about 2002, and the spy files were released from the Denver Police Department and then ultimately from the JTTF, one thing that we found was that most people's Denver Police spy files were about maybe for organizations 5, 6, 10, maybe 30 pages. When we made the request for the American Indian Movement of Colorado's files, the first request we got was about 150 pages. And then we said, we know that that's not all. So we kept pressing, about 300 pages, then about 500 pages. Finally, they released 1,500 pages to us, far surpassing any other organization, any other individuals. There were documents in the file that indicated that some of us were to be assassinated.
the FBI had confirmed evidence that some of us were to be assassinated.
By who?
By different people who didn't like us. And so the Denver police had that information and didn't release it to us. And so, as you can see, it didn't come to fruition, but not because of any efforts by the FBI or the Denver police to stop it. And so that's an expression, though, of this continuing anti-Indian ideology, even in the Denver Police Department, in the city officials today who refuse to take a position against this hate speech that began in their city, or state officials, state legislators who refuse to take a position against this hate speech that emanated from this state.
Glenn Morris, we only have two more minutes, but when you came into the studio here today at Rocky Mountain PBS, you brought a large photograph of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld speaking in Fort Carson several years ago. Why?
To us, that represents this continuing ideology, this hegemony that Chomsky talks about. And it is confirmation that Rumsfeld and Cheney and the Rumsfeld-Cheney doctrine around the world is an expression that began, an expression of policy that began with Columbus, continued through the entire Indian War period of the United States, and continues today. If you look at this picture, you'll see that Rumsfeld is giving a speech, sending off U.S. soldiers from Fort Carson, which is itself a semiotic, you know, this symbolism of colonialism. Kit Carson was not a hero to Native people. Kit Carson was an Indian killer. He caused the relocation of Diné people to Bosque Redondo. He engaged in the Sacramento River Massacre in the 1840s. So Kit Carson was not a heroic figure
How
either.
How was Kit Carson connected to Fort Carson?
It's named after Kit Carson. The Fort Carson is named after Kit Carson. So Rumsfeld is giving the speech at Fort Carson, about to send off these soldiers immediately behind him to Iraq. But behind those soldiers is the color guard for Fort Carson. And you'll notice that they're in different uniforms. They're in the uniforms of the Indian Wars of the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. And those soldiers represent the continuity. The soldiers immediately behind Rumsfeld represent the continuity of the Indian Wars. That is expressed by the color guard, still dressed in the uniform of Custer, of Sheridan, of Crook, of the other Indian killers of the 19th century. And if you look at the picture, you'll see that those soldiers have yellow kerchiefs around their neck. So all these people who have the support the troops magnets on their car that are yellow ribbons, that's the genesis of that. That they even made in, I believe it was 1949, John Wayne made a movie with John Ford called She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. And the tradition of those yellow ribbons is that the cavalry that would go out to kill Indians before they left, they would take that yellow kerchief off, tie it in their wife or their girlfriend's hair, and say, you wear this until I come back safely from killing Indians. So the Indian Wars continue even in these little icons. That's hegemony. It's so impervious. It's so pervasive in the society that we don't even recognize it.
Glenn Morris, a member of the Leadership Council of the American Indian Movement at Colorado, and Glenn Spagnuolo, with Transform Columbus Day Alliance. And finally, on a lighter note, last night I had the pleasure of visiting Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report. Well, this is a clip.
Let me talk about the reddest state
in
the nation.
I'm not going to let you do anything. You're going to have to earn every inch of this interview, young lady. You don't come into my house and get me to let you do anything. I heard you were a firebrand. Well, bring it, baby.
And if you didn't catch the whole thing last night, the Colbert Report re-airs today at 2:30 and 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Comedy Central. It's also available on podcast. Well, we continue the Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. Tonight, I'll be in Ashland, Oregon at 7:30 at Southern Oregon University. Tomorrow morning at noon at the Lafayette Arinda Presbyterian Church in Lafayette, California. Then 3 at Sacramento City College. Tomorrow night at 7, I'll be at the Spangenberg Theater in Palo Alto. And on Sunday at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont at 7 p.m. next Wednesday. I'll be at State University of New York at Buffalo. You can see the whole tour at democracynow.org, where we are also podcasting, video and audio podcasting, Democracy Now!, as well as all our transcripts are there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jen Yutz, Mike DiFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Rebecca Silver and Jerome Bourgeois and Kieran Krug-Meadows, Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney, Angela Alston, Uri Galed. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.